Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, an inside look at opening night at America Fest and the local band whose latest album pays homage to Phoenix's past. But first, it is the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
More than 75,000 Arizona children, one in four, have parents who need childcare but can't access it.
The single most important task that we will work on over the coming 2 years that will produce the greatest positive benefit for the people of Arizona possible is our efforts to fire Katie Hobbs, Chris Mays, and Adrian Fontes in the 2026 election.
I committed to making sure Arizona could be a state, just like so many other states, who has election results night of, instead of being the state who delivered their electoral results last.
70% of voters are confident in our election results. So this nonsense about so many people wanting the election results right away and therefore we have to jeopardize voter access is just ridiculous.
Does it need to be to the ballot by May? Maybe, maybe not. And I think what's most important is that we have a good deal that supports public education.
The state legislature is requiring that the governor and the attorney general obey federal law when it comes to immigration.
It's clear to me that you're not being honest with us or the American people because you know the truth would disqualify you from getting the job.
And joining me to talk about Governor Hobbs' State of the State speech, a proposal to make Arizona elections more like Florida's and more, our former state lawmaker, Regina Cobb. Regina, good morning.
Good morning.
And Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting. Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Sam, let me start with you. Just general reaction to Governor's State of the State speech. I mean, everybody stayed and faced her this time, so yeah. I guess that's an improvement over past years,
right? A great starting point, absolutely. And I was absolutely pleased. I thought that her poise, her obvious preparation, really, really great writing, frankly. The delivery was wonderful. I also, because of the way that this first week of the legislature goes, I was lucky enough to see it another couple times at the local kind of regional chambers that hosted her give the speech again. So I really, really appreciated the narrative that it cast for the remaining time in her first term and really set up the stage for what really is an in-cycle moment for the political time we're in.
Regina, what do you make of it?
I agree. The speech was well written. I think that oftentimes when they give a speech, I would like to see it come from the heart. When they read a speech, it's difficult. And that's the only thing I would say about as far as the presentation goes. I feel like that a lot of times that you get more accomplished if you just speak from your heart. There was a lot of things in there that have changed over the last few years, like border and her need to now be a border czar when, you know, she wasn't before. What I do like about it was there was a lot of conversation about water. I feel like Governor Hobbs hasn't got a lot accomplished in the last few years. And if water is something that she could get accomplished in the next few years, that would be a huge accomplishment.
It's interesting you mentioned about some of the topics and maybe the tone shifting a little bit, because there's been a lot of talk, obviously, with Republicans at both the state and the national level having more control than they did, or at least on the state level, having bigger majorities in the legislature, that, you know, the governor might have to. For example, there's a lot of talk when she said that the Laken Riley Act on the federal level she was supportive of. Did it surprise you at all, some of the stuff that she talked about that maybe, I mean, she still talked about ESAs and how she wants to try to, you know, rein those in a little bit or shrink the program a little bit. Was this maybe as much of a Democratic speech, I guess, as she's given in the past?
No, it wasn't. It was more of an independent speech. And I think this is coming up 2 years before an election cycle, and that usually happens. They all of a sudden you go from very Republican to independent, very Democrat to independent, and I expected what I heard.
And Sam, there was a lot of talk about like the speech maybe being sort of the kickoff of the governor's 2026 reelection campaign.
I mean, I think that's a definitely a reality because that's the moment that we're in. But I think what I heard more is a speech for Arizonans, right? And I think that what we saw in this election that we just finished was really a moment to reflect and respond. And I thought that what Governor Hobbs did with this speech was really be responsive to the moment and the message that Arizona voters provided, because all of our attention is on what happened just a few short 60, 75 days ago, right, and at the election. But I think folks forget that 2 years ago, Governor Hobbs won to be the duly elected governor of Arizona, and she has the right to speak and cast a vision for the Arizona that she sees. And I thought the Arizona dream narrative in the speech was my favorite thread throughout the whole thing.
So, Regina, you both have been down at the Capitol this week. I'm curious what kind of vibe you're getting in terms of whether or not this is going to be a year when people get stuff done, whether this is going to be a year when there's a lot of squabbling, either partisan or otherwise. Is it too early to get that kind of sense, or did you have something?
Oh, I think it's less than what it has been in the past. And one of the things that probably indicated it was is that everybody was sitting forward and listening to the speech. So I think we want to get things passed this year. I don't want to have a ballot initiative on every issue,
yeah,
and trying to work with that. And that there's some big issues out there. One that could, like I said, one that could be a bipartisan issue is water. And I think they need to get something done. And the Republicans want to go from ag to urban. Governor Hobbs wants to do rural water. I think there's a common ground somewhere in between the two. And I think you could get both done.
Sam, did you get a vibe from being down there this year?
Yeah.
Or this week?
Well, this week felt like a year. So that's fair. But I think that, one of my takeaways is that we absolutely have a number of freshmen coming into the Capitol this year. But they're relatively, compared to the last few election cycles, we have a smaller number of freshmen. So I think there's a little bit of a sense that this is not just summer camp. Like we're seeing each other again, right? Like there's a little bit more of a gelling, right? The team is coming together. And yes, we know which jerseys we're all wearing, but but you know, we also know each other's kids' names. And you know, we're going to ask to see how everyone's doing. And I think that, congeniality has definitely come through in this first week or so.
Let me ask you one last question on this, Regina, because you've been a state legislator, you've been in the chamber during States of the State speech. How much does that really set the tone for what's to come over the next couple of months?
What that does, and Governor Ducey was a lot like Governor Hobbs is. They're setting their feet in cement. They're saying, this is where I'm going to be standing at. You just got to be able to move one direction or another on that. And so it does kind of set the tone. I always hated it when the governor came up with the budget first. I felt like it
should. Which the governor will release her budget later today.
She will. And I think that's a travesty. I actually think that sets a wrong tone, because I think that it should come out of the House as it does in the federal government. And so I don't agree with that. But the same thing, as soon as her budget's going to come out, it's going to say, this is what I want. This is where I'm going to go to. And there's no secrets then. It's all out there.
Sam, let me ask you about Prop 123, which is the measure that was passed a decade ago to get more money into schools. It was voter approved. It is going to expire this year, and there's been a lot of talk about efforts to renew it. My colleague Wayne Shutsky this week reported that it doesn't seem like there's necessarily a whole lot of hurry at the Capitol to do this, to get it on a special election ballot this spring.
Yeah, I think that some of that is because we have cleared the hurdle in terms of convincing the right people that this is important to do. So that box is checked. There's less of a sense of urgency because we all know and understand the importance of getting this done. And I think you heard in the clips right before we came on, Leader Sundaration speaking about the fact that we don't want to just shove something to the ballot without thinking through every little detail, right? This was a deeply, deeply complex issue that we're talking about, taking money from the state land trust and maybe adjusting a percentage that has to, you know, run against actuarial tables. And there's a whole bunch of different trustees. It's not just the K-12 system, right? We have, you know, state land, federal land that we have to work through, and all, and that isn't even talking about yet the deeply complex education policy questions that are going to be at the table. Do we give this money to districts with no strings attached, or do we give some programmatic directions? Should go to teachers, or this should go to support, you know, a classroom site fund or things like that. So all of those questions I know are being discussed at length right now. I think that there was some sense of urgency that may have been, I would don't say a false sense of urgency, but there was some misunderstanding about what needed to happen procedurally to get the question to the ballot at the right time and in the right way. My understanding is that all that has been settled. So behind the scenes, all of those questions are being answered, and I see you're going to see a grand bargain come through the legislature, referred to the ballot, and it'll be mailed to people for those that are on PEVL, or will be able to vote at the polls likely sometime this fall.
At the same time, though, Regina, it seemed like last year there was also agreement that something had to be done. I mean, the governor had a plan. There are a couple different plans in the Republican-controlled legislature. But the proverbial devil was in the proverbial details. I mean, is that still the case?
It's still the case. I think that when you talk to the Republicans, they want all of it to go to teacher pay. When you talk to Governor Hobbs, she wants it to go to district additional assistance so that it goes to wherever is needed within the district.
Yeah.
So I think that they're going to have to come up with the policy that's good. The amount needs to be, you know, that needs to be negotiated.
What percentage?
What percentage? Are we keeping the same percentage? You know, Treasurer Yee wants to drop it.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Hobb wants to raise it so that there's more money there. You've got to protect the corpus, but we've proven that we could do that at the level that it's at right now. I don't know if you raise it, if you're going to protect the corpus of the fund. So I think that's going to be a big part of it too.
Sam, do you think that with all these sort of discrepancies in the details, are you still optimistic that something will get done?
I'm highly optimistic. I think just to circle back on what I was saying earlier, I think that there is no question at the Capitol that this needs to happen. And that's a really great place to start a discussion, right? If we have an agreement that we need to answer this question, then we can get straight to how we're going to answer that question. That's where the discussion is right now.
All right. That is Sam Richard. I'm also joined by Regina Cobb. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting and former state lawmaker Regina Cobb. Regina, let me start with you on Senate Bill 1011. Who knows what all the numbers are? I'm not expecting you to know it, but this is the bill that would essentially make some changes to Arizona's election system. It's trying to make it a little bit more like Florida's. The big takeaway here seems to be that early ballot drop-off is cut off at 7 p.m. on the Friday before Election Day, as opposed to giving voters the opportunity to drop their ballots off on Election Day, which, of course, causes some delays in counting the so-called late earlies. This seems to be something that a lot of Republicans from Tom Galvin and Stephen Richer on down are in favor of. Democrats still not. Is this something that you think would improve the situation in Arizona?
Absolutely. I think there's a few other things that could be done, but this is definitely the biggest reason that we're behind. It was an embarrassment this last year that we were so far behind in counting our ballots comparison to the rest of the nation, us in Nevada. And I feel like that this is a good start to go that direction. There's efficiencies all over, but this is probably the biggest reason that we're behind on the rest of the nation.
Sam, this is something that maybe seems like Governor Hobbs would not support. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I've seen in some public statements that she's offered that there is a lot of room that she would like to offer in terms of room to discuss some of those efficiencies that are there in the system. But I think this specific idea maybe has some challenges that need to be further addressed. I mean, I think that I'll go back to one of your questions. You said, is there room for improvement? I'm not sure that what is being fixed in this bill was actually broken. And I know I'll differ with Regina a little bit on that, in the sense that, you know, for those of us with longer memories in the election cycles of Arizona past, it's always been like this. What is new is that Arizona is a little bit more of a competitive state. So, you know, we need to be there. And what's ironic now is that Florida is much less of a swing state. So, like, those results were pretty much signed, sealed, and delivered by all the pundits and whatnot. So you didn't need to really wait for those elections. But we do a very good and responsible job of counting the ballots and providing voter access. And I think that is the thread that Governor Hobbs and legislative Democrats are going to be carrying through, is does this change access to the ability to cast your vote? And that's the singular threat.
And I think that it doesn't change your access to vote. You're dropping it off 3 days sooner. We've changed primary dates. We've done those kind of and we've all adjusted to it. So you adjust to saying, I'm not going to do it 3 days later. I'm going to do it by Friday. So I don't think it disenfranchises anybody.
Is there sort of a compromise to be had here in terms of a way, and maybe this is too technical for this conversation, but like, is there a way to have voters have the ability to continue to drop their ballots off up to Election Day, but still not have to wait, you know, a week or more after Election Day to verify the signature and count the ballot and process and all that? Like, does it have to be one or the other here?
I think it does. I think it does. It has to be one or the other, because you have to be able to verify those ballot signatures. And if you can't do it ahead of time, now you're doing it during the election cycle when you're counting all the other voters.
And I think that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think there is some room to do both of those. And I had to throw in a gum.
Sugar-free gum.
Sugar-free. Yeah. I'm sitting next to a dentist. I gotta be good about that.
Non-fluoridated.
But I think that, you know, having this discussion, and, you know, we were kind of chatting a little bit earlier about this, that, you know, this is where conversations should start, right? We're not talking about Sharpies. We're not talking about bamboo in the ballots. There's, you know, not any 2,000 mules type of a conversation. This is very, very healthy. And I was lucky enough to be in the room for the hearing on that bill. And I even thought that the tone and the tenor of the overall conversation, folks disagreed coming from a place of, you know, positive assumptions of intent, right? I think even Senator Ortiz's lines of questioning really opened up to some of those lines that you were talking about. Is there a way to maybe provide a path that if you drop off your ballot through on Election Day, it can be counted maybe right there or shortly after, so we're not waiting weeks after?
Is that a function, Sam, do you think, of the results of the 2024 election?
I don't think that the recency and our experience there hurt at all. We continue to have competitive elections that require that, like, intrigue, but I also think that democracy is worth waiting for, and I think that we're going to hear that over and over again. And I didn't come up with that line, but it's a good one, so I use it as often as I can.
We'll give you credit for it. Regina, let me ask you about something going on in D.C. A lot of President-elect Trump's cabinet appointees or nominees are having their confirmation hearings, and one of the most widely watched one was for Secretary of Defense nominee Pete Hegseth. Of course, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly on the Senate Armed Services Committee. His line of questioning, and I will admit to not watching the entire hearing but seeing bits and pieces of it, he had some very specific questions about very specific incidents, and Mr. Hegseth's answers were generally two words: anonymous smears. I'm wondering, like, if you are Mark Kelly and you have been on that dais questioning people, not specifically in that setting, but questioning people, like, what is that like when you kind of know that you're not actually going to get an answer to the question that you're asking?
It's difficult if you're not going to get the answer, but also, why are they asking some of the questions that they were asking? Some of them go back, I mean, 30, 40 years. If you go back to any of our histories of any person, we've changed, we've evolved. And the person that you are is the person that you are now. So I think the line of questioning sometimes is a little difficult. And I don't think Mark Kelly expected an answer. And so he just wanted to put it out there.
What did you make of how, especially how Senator Kelly handled that situation?
I think that, excuse me, overall, this is a spectacle, right? This is the period of time. So I think that all aspects of a hearing are going to have elements of, you know, what has that shock value. I do think that Senator Kelly asked a series of very important questions. He understands the military, so did that entire panel, right? And Mr. Hegseth wants to be the secretary of the world's largest military apparatus, and I think that there are some very important questions that need to be answered. So I think that there was an element of that spectacle piece, but I do think that these are important questions of the people who we are going to look to for leadership of our most important institutions.
All right. Last topic I want to get to. Attorney General Chris Mays this week asked now former special counsel Jack Smith for his files and his report in the so-called fake electors case. There's a lot of sort of moving parts in this, and there are questions about whether Jack Smith is going to be prosecuted, for example, by the next administration. I'm curious, Regina, like, how important do you think it is to continue this case? How important do you think it is for Attorney General Mays to get this file and to be able to continue her investigation in her case?
And I questioned that already as soon as I heard about that. I think this is move on. Let's move on. We've got past that point. I don't think that – I mean, I think Attorney General Mays is trying to politic. You know, again, she's going to be running for governor or attorney general again. I think she said recently that she's going to be running for attorney
re-election,
general.
Yeah.
Re-election for attorney general. But this is politicking. And get past it. Go on to something that you really need to be working on.
Sam, do you agree?
I think that it was definitely the right move, right? Someone was leaving office, did an amazing set of work. Amazing is the wrong word, but an in-depth amount of work to set up that investigation and potential action in litigation. So I think Attorney General Mays asking for that was just the right move. I think there's always an element of politics, but I think that in the case of these fake electors, there were some serious allegations that need to be answered in a serious way. And to not lose all of the work that Jack Smith did, I think is an important move.
Stipulating that none of the three of us in this room are attorneys, I don't think any of us are attorneys.
No.
I certainly am not. Do you guys think she's going to get these files?
I don't know. I don't think so. But you never know, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not an attorney. I'm a dentist.
I can't answer that with any level of authority, but it would be interesting to see what happens when she does and the new administration comes in. Are they going to ask for them back?
Yeah.
Right. I think that we're going to see this kind of,
roll back and forth.
Yeah. It's
that should go away. You know, that's like I said, we need to focus on things of importance. And this is not one of those.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Regina Cobb, Sam Richard, thank you so much for the conversation. Really nice to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, an album sprinkled with obscure Phoenix TV and radio advertisements. We'll hear from the band Astrologer about their love letter to the Valley. But first, as the dust settles on the 2024 election and the inauguration looms, many Americans are still processing what happened last November, including the show's Sam Dingman.
Ever since the election, I've had this feeling. Maybe you've had it too. A sense that something fundamental about our politics has changed. We've all heard the cable news explanations for Trump's victory, economic anxiety, outrage about border policy. But for me, there's something else in the air, something those tired buzzwords don't quite capture, something that might explain why 55% of young men voted for Trump. A 14-point swing from 2020, according to one post-election survey. And for a while now, I've been wondering if that something is right under my nose. There is a group based here in Phoenix that you've probably heard of, Turning Point USA. Turning Point is a sprawling right-wing operation, and maybe it's just because I live here, but for much of last year, it felt like they came up in every story I read about the election. I kept hearing about critical pieces of campaign infrastructure that Trump had outsourced to Turning Point, voter turnout in particular. and in articles about key figures in Trump's orbit, amongst the familiar hodgepodge of far-right agitators and opportunists, there was a new name, Charlie Kirk, the 31-year-old founder of Turning Point. And so, about 6 weeks after Trump's victory, I went to the Phoenix Convention Center for an event that Turning Point calls America Fest. For the land of the free and the home of the brave. America Fest is many things: a gathering of high school and college activists, a pop-up market for health supplements that list things like patriotic spirit and godly devotion on their ingredient labels, and above all, a four-day victory lap. On the first night of America Fest, a crowd of thousands swarmed the main hall at the convention center to watch a 20-minute hype video celebrating Turning Point's impact on the 2024 election.
Young men are now more conservative than they have been in 50 years.
At the end of the video, the lights went out. And then a picture of Turning Point founder Charlie Kirk flashed on screen.
The single most effective organizer of conservatives in the United States.
One of the most formidable.
Chest-rattling house music erupted from the speakers. The crowd went wild. Kirk appeared in silhouette behind a baffle, and then strolled out on stage, his arms stretched wide.
Welcome to America Fest, everybody.
After a confetti cannon went off and the Thank You Charlie chants died down, Kirk launched into a stem winder. By the grace of God Almighty, he told the crowd, America had survived the Biden administration. The last 4 years, he declared, had been an embarrassment. But not, it would seem, because of expensive groceries or gas prices. In fact, Kirk barely talked about the economy or the border, which garnered only passing mention and even then only tepid applause.
To see our taxpayer dollars being sent to Ukraine while our southern border remains wide open. Donald Trump loved his nation so much.
What troubled Charlie Kirk most, it seemed, was the loss of our national virility.
We're sick and tired of hearing about toxic masculinity when we are drowning in toxic femininity. When we become a feelings-based culture, you can't say that, you can't do that, you're going to offend somebody. And who is the most overtly masculine political figure of the last 100 years? It's the man who would never apologize for America. That isn't
for Charlie Kirk, the re-election of Donald Trump was a return to American masculinity.
And in many ways, this was an election that was more about culture than it was about politics. That it was about who are we as a people.
In Kirk's ideal world, we are a people unmoved by feelings. Ironically, moments after he said that, the crowd rose to its feet as he began denouncing trans people.
We need to end the medical mutilation of our children called gender-affirming care.
And it was here, when Kirk started shouting about gender, that the applause became anything but tepid. It was deafening.
Controversial thing to say 3 or 4 years ago. It took a little bit of a masculine chip on the shoulder to say, no, actually, I'm not going to allow that to happen. You see, they wanted us to be quiet and afraid and silent and subservient.
I will admit, when I heard this, I couldn't help thinking that having a masculine chip on the shoulder sounds a lot like men having hurt feelings. But that evidently is not what Charlie Kirk meant. For him, the problem was other people's feelings.
Young men want to be part of a political movement that doesn't hate them. In fact, let me go a step further, that thinks they're essential to a future of a country. That we need strong.
In the convention hall, after Kirk's speech, I tracked down some of these young men. Meet Owen.
Yeah, I run the Turning Point USA chapter at Florida State University.
And James.
I'm a Turning Point ambassador, and I also run my own social media, conservative influencer type things.
Owen and James are both in their 20s. They were both wearing suits, and like Charlie Kirk, they were both in a panic about gender.
You know, a male holds open the door, and it's like, well, a woman can do it on her own. Well, I just want to be a nice person and hold open the door. It's not that I think a female can't hold the door for herself. It's just, I want to be nice.
Why, James lamented, won't women just let him be nice? Why must they assume that his attempts at chivalry are in fact an attempt to belittle them?
So how I look at it is, and the reason you have this red pill movement is because young men have felt forgotten.
There they are again, those pesky emotions. I asked James if he agreed with Charlie Kirk that we shouldn't be a nation based on feelings. But once again, it seemed I was missing the point. Men's feelings weren't the problem.
That feeling comes from action towards men. So when you say, hey, okay, you can put a male in a dress and he's now female. And if a male wants to paint his nails, if we say, hey, that's not what men do. Men need to be strong so they can protect their family and work hard and build a long-lasting legacy. Then they attack that. So,
but I just have to say, I think the pushback to that would be that if a man decides they want to wear a dress and identify as a woman, that doesn't necessarily mean they can't work hard or protect their family.
I think when you allow those gender roles, or specifically those two things, to be misconstrued, in my personal opinion, that diminishes masculinity and that diminishes malehood.
Owen agreed. Malehood is under attack, as is femalehood.
With women, you have the masculinization of them. You say, you know, especially with young women, go to college, go get a job, prioritize these things, these individual interests over family creation, you know, relationships, connections, things like that.
But is that inherently masculine to go to college and have a job?
I would say that in order to provide for a family, you know, the purpose of having a job, getting an education, is, you know, the ability to provide for a family, to provide for something greater than yourself. And I think if a man tried to argue that that's masculinity, that's completely wrong. The inversion of gender roles is really the biggest problem that we're actually having. And it's confusing young people, and it's how you end up with men wearing dresses.
I'm not sure I followed Owen's logic there, or James's, for that matter. But I also can't blame them for being confused. They both told me that they grew up without fathers. And that, they said, is one of the things that draws them to men like Donald Trump and Charlie Kirk, and the man who closed out night one of America Fest, Tucker Carlson.
Thank you! That is amazing. Thank you very much! Thank you!
After another blast of confetti from on high, Carlson gave a meandering speech that called for isolationist foreign policy, vaccine skepticism, and the end of abortion rights. He paused periodically to stuff a nicotine pouch into his lip. And like Charlie Kirk, Carlson's message was fueled by a kind of patriarchal grievance. At one point, he urged the crowd to hold centrist Republicans accountable.
And anyway, just make them obey. I think that's up to us. Don't be charmed by them. Force them. Spank them like the bad little girls they are. Thank you.
Towards the end of the speech, Carlson opened the floor for questions. A young man with dimples and a sharp jawline approached the mic.
So, hi, Tucker. My name's Jake. My question is about nicotine.
Yeah.
So, I see your little packet. I don't know if that's Zyn or Alp, but from what I hear, you know, nicotine comes with a bunch of benefits. Increasing testosterone. Love that. So it's my 16th birthday today, and when did you start taking nicotine, and would you recommend taking nicotine?
Carlson would indeed recommend it.
I'm just telling you what worked for me. I don't drink or use drugs of any kind, including Advil, and I haven't for 22 years. I don't put any chemicals in my body whatsoever other than nicotine and black coffee, and I feel great. I do.
I couldn't find Jake in the crowd after Carlson's speech, which is too bad. I wanted to know what he thought of Tucker's answer. After all, it's just how he feels.
How do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel? Tell me how do you...
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Growing up in Phoenix in the 1980s and 90s, there are some figures you'd be familiar with. Wallace and Ladmo, the stars of the offbeat kids show on Channel 5, or Tex Earnhardt, the cowboy hat-wearing auto dealership owner of countless TV commercials. Those are some of the folks that our next guest was thinking about as he wrote the 17 songs on the latest double album from Phoenix band Astrologer. You'll even hear some of the old advertisements mixed into the album. Andrew Cameron Klein is a fourth-generation Arizonan and lead singer of the band, which also includes his wife, Candy Caballero Klein. The pair recorded the album on four-track tapes in their downtown Phoenix apartment complex, the Fleetwood, with their bandmates and neighbors. It's called Astrologer Fleetwood Sprawl, and they've called it a love letter to the Phoenix Andy grew up in and that Candy is learning to love. They both came into our studios recently to talk more about it with my co-host, Lauren Gilger.
This whole album is like a series of happy accidents. We set out to demo a record and then thought to ourselves that the demo sounds really good. And then that started kind of dredging up memories of learning how to record and learning how to write songs just so I could learn to record them on a four track. It took me back to that time of sitting in my room and remembering a lot of the Phoenix that I remember, where maybe we weren't as urban, I guess. I'm not sure. It wasn't as developed. It was still sort of you had to have a car to go anywhere, and everything was several miles away. But there was a lot of personality, and it started feeling like, wow, how can we sort of elucidate this feeling that I have of nostalgia for my childhood? And then Candy started, why don't you explain?
Well, I was thinking right now, it's kind of cheesy, but I feel like since I've met you and the fact that you're from the city, you've taught me a lot about the history of Phoenix. And it brings up my own memories of, like, I'm from Los Angeles and there is a lot of parallels. And it's weird because people from Phoenix, especially like artists and musicians, they always felt the need to like compare themselves to things that are happening over there. Mm-hmm. And as I moved here, I realized that, like, we have the same history. It's always being erased, and it's always, like, you're kind of, like, reaching for something that's always just out of reach.
And you were there before. An icon of an endless dream just behind the door.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to ask you about that because I've interviewed a lot of bands over the years. There are a lot of bands from Phoenix who don't want to admit they're from Phoenix, who want to pretend they're from L.A. or something like that. This is so interesting to me because it's so outrightly about Phoenix, like, and about this place and kind of owning it.
Yeah. I feel like it's kind of a shame, too, because people are like, they're not admitting your own history, your own heritage. Like, you're just kind of erasing that, just like it's happening all the time in the city.
I think that people in their sort of race to become known as credible to Los Angeles, who, by the way, they don't really care about what we're doing in the first place because they're obsessed with being the forefront of what's cool. But that's what makes us cool, is that we're not L.A.
So let's talk about those advertisements, Candy. This was your idea to put them in, right? Like, these are old kind of deep cut ads from Phoenix from a long time ago.
A large Peter Piper special, $4.50, and that's the most expensive pizza on our menu. So come on over to Peter Piper Pizza.
And they're sort of spliced in within songs, between songs. It almost sounds like it's like they're part of the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought of it more of like a sound collage and kind of like a way to bridge the gap.
It helps with the cohesion of the album, especially if you listen to it. 17 songs is a long record any stretch. But I remember when we were trying to think about the sequence and how do you put this much stuff and they sound so wildly different. And Candy used the sort of tool of using these commercials in a way to make it feel like an album and also not allow it to become a slog.
Hmm. And remember, folks, we lease all makes and models at Earnhardt's Progressive Leasing at the corner of Baseline Rural right here in Tempe.
Talk about where you found these ads. Like, these are really not even the ones that I remember from childhood. These are a little more obscure.
I spend so much time on YouTube just deep digging everything and anything. And it was sort of just like, oh, I wonder if, you know, I wonder where I can find some Tex Earnhardt commercials. I wonder where I can find this and that. And some of that stuff was there.
Yeah.
You know, it has like 100 views and it was posted like 15 years ago, but it's
there. Bless the people on YouTube that archive the most obscure things.
Yeah, indeed.
So it's interesting because it's like nostalgic for you on two levels then, it sounds like. It's nostalgic for you on this level of revisiting your childhood, but also it's nostalgic in remembering this year you spent making this music.
Yeah, it was a unique time. I think also now that it's finished and now we're about a year out from that, it is like immediately nostalgic because I think of Candy and Blake and Nick, our other guitarist, and Julian. Julian sings backup on
your son? Yeah. Wow, that's awesome.
He sings backup on a couple of things. I think of the enduring impact of a few of the songs like Heart of Mine. Lighthouse comes to mind. There are songs that I consider probably some of the best that I've ever written, and they're sort of mixed in with things that aren't the best thing I ever written, but it's like, it's endearing. It feels real.
Yeah.
That year went by so quickly and things changed so quickly too. And just like, I feel like even our apartment complex may or may not exist in a couple years, you know? So it's kind of like that documentation is really important
God
for the sake of
the
it.
Fleetwoods.
Yeah.
So I want to end with a couple of questions for each of you about what this means, how it affected your view of Phoenix. I want to start with you, Candy, because you're not from here.
Yeah.
You've lived here for some years, but not your whole life or four generations like Andrew here.
Yeah.
But what did this process of making this album with him and in this place and about this place teach you or make you feel about Phoenix?
Oh, my gosh, so many things. But I feel like I'm constantly uncovering different layers and learning and having a lot of pride for the city. I feel like it's an underdog city and we need people to advocate for it. And we need more artists to live in this city and like to lift each other up.
Yeah. What about you, Andrew? What is this album and the process of making it made you think and feel about Phoenix?
The last couple of years have been a real sort of learning experience because the album, as we made it, became this sort of homage to not only to nostalgia itself, but to the Phoenix that I miss and the figures of Phoenix like Wallace and Ladmo and Tex Earnhardt and, I mean, many others. Don't get me started. Beth and Bill. Beth is still around.
She is, yeah.
it was something that kind of made me feel a little bit melancholic about Phoenix, because I was like, wow, are we losing all of this? Are we losing all of these things that I really love? And to some extent we are. But since we finished this album and it came out and we've had such a great response from people, now there's a flourishing of ideas.
Yeah.
So that's how I feel about it. I'm proud to be from here. I'm proud of specific things from here that I don't want to be lost to the sands of time. And that's pretty much what we're here to do.
So now you're looking forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Andrew Cameron Klein, Candy Caballero Klein, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.